Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. Can I begin by thanking the former Shadow Europe Minister and now the current Shadow Europe Ministers for providing this bill with what we judge to be an appropriate and necessary level of scrutiny during both the committee and the report stage. I'd also like to thank the other committee members and contributors to those debates, indeed the proposer of the bill, who spoke today. That was a particular pleasure, but has at least been present during the times that the bill has been debated and discussed over recent weeks. I want to open my remarks on this third reading of the Private Members' Bill by briefly addressing the points raised in discussions during the committee and report stage. Alas, this bill comes to third reading with all of the fundamental issues and concerns that were raised on second reading and committee stage still unresolved, with the exception of the issue of Gibraltar, where I'm glad to say we were able to make some progress from the Labour side. In truth, Madam Deputy Speaker, this is not a bill about the Conservatives trusting the public, but about Conservative backbenchers not trusting a Conservative Prime Minister. Any judgment about... I'll make a little progress and then I'll be happy to take some interventions. Let's just be clear as to what's even happened in the course of recent weeks. The bill started with a breakfast at Downing Street for Conservative backbenchers. Last week, the Prime Minister again offered Conservative backbenchers breakfast at Downing Street. It's not clear whether it was a continental breakfast, but it was certainly breakfast at Downing Street. The Prime Minister seems to be seeking unity through a strategy of obesity. He is clearly worried that if he's not doing the cooking, then all too shortly he'll be on the menu. Any judgment about an in-out referendum on the United Kingdom's membership of the European Union has to be based on what is in the UK's national interest. We do not believe that this bill's proposal for an in-out referendum in 2017 is in the national interest, and that is why we are not supporting it. This bill anticipates an arbitrary timetable for an in-out referendum in 2017 in the United Kingdom, divorced from any serious assessment of the likely timetable for treaty change across Europe. When the Prime Minister first announced his new policy back in January, he argued that treaty change was inevitable, necessary and indeed desirable. He said in April, "I'm sure there will be treaty change." He went on to say, "I'm absolutely convinced that there will be the need to reopen at some stage these treaties." And yet, Madam Deputy Speaker, the prospect of treaty change now seems less likely today than it was when the Prime Minister made those remarks about which the Foreign Secretary has spoken only a moment ago. Indeed, it is significant that the German government in particular now seems less inclined to push for immediate treaty change, instead favouring intergovernmental agreements under Article 114 of the EU Treaty. Indeed, in May this year, the German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble said explicitly, "Banking union is a central project. We need institutional changes, but we cannot wait for a treaty change." And, Madam Deputy Speaker, only this week, the Grand Coalition document that will form the basis of the German administration's governing agenda was agreed, and it made not a single reference to the prospect of treaty change. The truth is that the date of 2017 had more to do with Tory party management than EU-wide treaty change. The Honourable Gentleman, the Right Honourable Gentleman, very gracious, I'll take his intervention now.
To the Right Honourable Gentleman, could I ask him, given the fact that the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, promised a referendum on the Constitution, in the context of this incredibly important bill, will he tell us whether or not the Labour Party has ruled out having a referendum on the European Union?
Well, Madam Deputy Speaker, I could not have asked for a kinder intervention, given that I'm very keen to talk about the views of former Prime Ministers of the United Kingdom. Why don't we start with the former member from Huntingdon? The truth is that this bill, although it is presented as a bill about Britain's relationship with Europe, it is much more to do, as I've said, with the Prime Minister's relationship with his party. Only last night, the member for Huntingdon, let's remember, that was actually the last Conservative Prime Minister who actually secured a majority in a general election, and also a man who, if I recollect, remembers a bit or two about dealing with querulous backbenchers, said that if Britain voted to leave the European Union, let me quote directly what he said, "In a world of 7 billion people, our island would be moving further apart from our closest and largest trading partners at the very time when they themselves are drawing closer together." This makes no sense at all. Not my words, the words of the last Conservative Prime Minister who secured a majority. But, Madam Deputy Speaker, he is not simply opposed to exit. He is also opposed to this bill, the former Prime Minister. As the former Prime Minister, the member for Huntingdon, said, "I'm not in favour of Mr Horton's bill." He went on, "I think the Horton bill is a negative, not a positive." And why does he believe that this is a bad bill? Because, Madam Deputy Speaker, he thinks that the Conservatives should be spending their time focusing on issues like, and again, let me quote him directly, taxes, jobs, education, health, and yes, wait for it, living standards. Yeah. He's not wrong, of course, but coming from a Conservative, you do have a sense that irony has left the building. Now, Madam Deputy Speaker, while the private rationale for this bill is to bind the Prime Minister's hands by committing him to a referendum, the public rationale is to strengthen the Prime Minister's hand in negotiations. The only problem is, as of today, indeed following the speech of the Foreign Secretary, we are no clearer to understanding exactly what that negotiating position is. The Prime Minister has chosen to try and achieve the veneer of unity through the device of obscurity. That's why when the Prime Minister delivered his speech last January, in which the Foreign Secretary sought to seek refuge only a few moments ago, I'm sure that members opposite do not need to be reminded of the fact the word repatriation did not appear 10 times, 5 times. It didn't appear once. He didn't utter the term opt-out. And the words employment law were never even mentioned. Indeed, Madam Deputy Speaker, during the course of the second reading debate, the Shadow Minister for Europe, I'm glad to see is back in his place, was asked, the Minister for Europe was asked by the Shadow Minister for Europe, who's in his place, whether he would enlighten the House as to which powers and competences the Prime Minister wants to repatriate to the UK. Alas, he missed that opportunity. If he'd like to take the opportunity now to intervene and explain which powers he's seeking to repatriate, I will more than happily give way. Suddenly, he seems to have found his briefing papers incredibly interesting. Now, he asked last week, and indeed the member for Gainsborough asked, the very same question. These are not simply questions that are being asked by the Labour side. These are being asked by the member for Gainsborough. But, Madam Deputy Speaker, alas, no answer was forthcoming. All we were greeted with was the sound of silence. The reason for this is that despite his speech, despite agreeing a date, and despite this bill, the truth still endures. The gap between what the Conservative backbenchers demand and what the Conservative Prime Minister can deliver remains achingly, achingly unbridgeable. Madam Deputy Speaker, on the day that this bill was presented for report stage, the Chief Executive of Nissan issued a stark warning to the Government about the prospects of the UK leaving the European Union, highlighting that jobs, investment and growth would be put at risk. As we've just heard from my honourable friend, the Member for Newcastle Central, there are very real and deep concerns in a number of regions of this country as to what the consequences of exit would be. The Chief Executive of Nissan said this, "Obviously it's going to be a major factor happening and we're going to need to consider what does it mean for us in the future. I'm not worried about Sunderland. Sunderland's a very competitive plant. It's a very productive plant and it's a European plant based in the UK. If anything has to change, we need to reconsider our strategy and our investments for the future." Indeed, in those remarks, he was echoing the remarks made by the Government of Japan, the Japanese embassy having contributed to the Foreign Secretary's Balance of Competences review. Let me just share with you the paragraph that they contributed on the issue of inward investment. "More than 1,300 Japanese companies have invested in the UK as part of the single market of the European Union and have created 130,000 jobs, more than anywhere else in Europe. This fact demonstrates that the advantage of the UK as a gateway to the European market has attracted Japanese investment. The Government of Japan expects the UK to maintain this favourable role." Madam Deputy Speaker, the EU gives us influence collectively that when we act alone, we would simply lack. And it does so at a time in our history when this has arguably never been more important. Not least because today we are living in the early years of what many regard as an Asian century. And as Asia rises, Europe must find new ways to amplify its voice and extend its influence. Defending the UK's place in the European Union is therefore not a matter of outdated sentiment. It is a matter of simple arithmetic. In an age of countries the size of continents, our membership of the European Union gives us access and influence to the world's biggest global trading bloc and the prize of opening up new markets as well. I will give way.
I'm grateful to my right honourable friend for giving way. He will know that the CBI estimate that up to 5% of the UK's total economic output could be lost if Britain withdraws from the EU. Would he share his thoughts with the House as to why he thinks that the Conservative Party and the government are so willing to put those jobs and investment at risk? Mm-hmm.
I fear because the dynamic and the driver of this bill, as is evidenced by the conduct of the bill, is now the management of the Conservative Party, not the interests of the country. If you look at the remarks of Sir Roger Carr and you look at the report produced by the CBI, it was a devastating critique. You don't need to take my word for it. Look at the remarks that I've just quoted from the former member for Huntingdon, the former Conservative Prime Minister, who recognised that this time of economic challenge is far too serious for the kind of risks that the Conservative Party now seem willing to consider running in order, they hope, to try and protect their own jobs while putting the jobs of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of British workers potentially at risk. The real tragedy, Madam Deputy Speaker, is that because the Prime Minister is unable to properly address the real need for reform in a sensible and effective way in Europe, he's been driven to this position. This bill is being brought forward by a party divided, in all reality, between those who are seeking consent and those who are seeking exit, united only in their mistrust of the Prime Minister. This bill is not about trusting the people, it's about Tory backbenchers not trusting a Tory Prime Minister. In these tough economic times, Britain deserves better. Reform in Europe, not exit from Europe, is the right course for our country. Yeah.